welcome to the Direction Democracy podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. This podcast is part of the Center for Political Communication's national agenda series, Direction Democracy, which examines where we've been, where we're going, and the current state of democracy in the United States. I'm your host, Tom Byrne, news director at Delaware Public Media. On this episode, we're joined again by UD Center for Political Communication Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, Dr. Lindsay Hoffman. Lindsay, thanks for being with us again.
As always, I love it.
And back to Newark from Iowa, where he's been spending his sabbatical this fall watching the presidential campaign develop, Dr. David Redlosk, chair of the University of Delaware Department of Political Science and International Relations. Thank you for joining us and making time to come visit us.
Absolutely happy to be here.
So a reminder that this is being recorded shortly after 3 p.m. on Thursday, November 7th, and we do realize that things could change between now and when you are listening to this podcast.
We're going to have to do that every time, aren't we?
Yes, well, it's kind of something you got to do now, particularly if you're doing political stuff. But since we have David here, we want to start with you and kind of pick your brain about the presidential campaign and what you're seeing on the front lines in Iowa. And I want to start with what we've opened the last couple shows with, which is impeachment. And in this case, asking you, David, as you watch the Democratic candidates interact with voters in Iowa, is impeachment a big deal to them? Is it a top issue, or is it something that's just kind of the political class is really interested in, but the average person may not be as?
The answer is a little of both in a way. Voters are not asking about impeachment in the Q&A sessions with presidential candidates, but if you listen to the crowd before and after, there's discussion amongst voters about what's going on in Washington, what they've been hearing, remembering that the people I'm hearing are generally fairly strong Democrats in the first place, or they wouldn't be going to Iowa caucus events. But I have been struck by the fact that the question of impeachment, or a question asking the candidates about impeachment, I have yet to actually hear.
And I guess there is, we've kind of talked about this before, that there may be kind of a disconnect between, you know, those of us who follow it closely and see like the kind of drip, drip, drip of news coming out of, you know, the transcripts and the closed door hearings and such like, and what the average person who's just kind of getting up each and every day is thinking about.
Well, and I think, Dave can certainly expand on this, I think people in Iowa are accustomed to themselves being in the spotlight at this point in a presidential campaign. So I think they're more focused on the role that they perceive to be as an important one for them to play.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, Iowans take this role very seriously. You know, Iowa has now been the first event in the nominating system since 1976, so we're in the 44th year of that. And Iowa voters, in the research I've done over the years, are much more engaged, involved, and paying attention to all of this. But in particular, the idea that they are kicking this off runs really deeply. And a great way to compare this, a few years ago, we looked at whether voters voted strategically or sincerely in primaries. And what we mean by that is a strategic voter is someone who worries about who can win, who can be nominated and who can win.
Electability,
essentially. Viability, electability. Mm-hmm. The sincere voter votes their true preference without worrying too much about whether that candidate can win or not. What we found is that Iowa caucus goers actually vote sincerely at a much higher rate than later primaries, even New Hampshire, even Super Tuesday states. So they take it seriously and they really do try to send a message to the rest of the country, not about electability, but about who they think is the right candidate.
Before we go a little bit more into what's going on the grounds in Iowa, I do want to take this to a practical level, presidential politics, yeah, impeachment, and Iowa. Listening to the NPR Politics podcast earlier this week, they touched on the possibility that many of the senators who are running could be forced away from Iowa, close to the caucus, to serve as jurors at a Senate impeachment trial, suggesting that that could be a real nightmare for the campaigns. You know Iowa. How much would that hurt Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker, if they had to walk away?
Michael Bennett. Don't forget Michael Bennett.
That's right. And I guess conversely, how much would that help a Joe Biden or a Pete Buttigieg who can stick around?
That's
right.
A good question.
It's a really good question. And I think by the time we reach, let's say, January, which would be it wouldn't happen sooner than January, but mm-hmm. by the time we reach January, these candidates will have been in Iowa literally hundreds of times, literally for hundreds of events each. And, you know, everyone will have seen them 4 or 5 or 6 times. So does it matter whether they're physically there or not? I don't know. I mean, this is unprecedented.
Right.
We're used to the intensity of the campaign ramping up in the last week mm-hmm. or two. If it doesn't ramp up the same way, it might be advantageous to Buttigieg, or it might help Joe Biden, just because when people are looking for events to go to, that's who will be there.
What about New Hampshire? Could it impact New Hampshire?
Well, I mean, it's sort of the same thing. New Hampshire only comes 8 days after Iowa. So, you know, whatever happens with Iowa is pretty much going to happen with New Hampshire as well. You know, in some sense, Nancy Pelosi kind of controls this schedule. When does this come to the floor of the House? When is Trump actually impeached? At that point, then the Senate controls it, presumably McConnell, but it also, you know, the impeachment is actually, the trial's actually the Chief Justice presides
right.
over. You know, I'm sure McConnell would be happy to do it in January if Trump were impeached by then.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me in some ways that politically, at least for the campaigns, it might be better if the House just waited a little bit longer. But I think in the end, we really don't know how it would play out. I'll add one other thing as I'm rambling on a bit here. Historically, Iowa Democrats are also very late deciders. We found both in 2008 and 2016 that about 60% made their decision in the last month. It may be just like that again this year, which would be a problem for those senators, I think.
And I guess, Lindsay, I'll ask you this, and Dave, you can weigh in if you want as well. I mean, in this day and age where you can be present electronically, you know, a video town hall or something like that, is that something that we have any feeling for would resonate with voters, that they go, okay, well, they can't physically be here, but they're gonna talk to us, you know, or is that connection really important?
You know, I'll say, put this in the context of our speaker that we had this week, former Governor Chris Christie. I can say that certainly being in the same room with him was very different from watching him on YouTube or mm-hmm. as the YouTube governor or whatever. I can say the same thing about Joe Biden. I'm sure Dave can say the same thing about just being in the same room with a person helps you to see the humanity in them, helps mm-hmm. you kind of identify like, oh, that's just another person. It's not this character that I see on screen.
No, I think that's exactly right. You know, there's nothing like literally being in the room. And then add to it that one of the relatively newer features is the selfie line. and particularly for Elizabeth Warren, this has become a thing.
Mm-hmm. Takes hours.
Yeah, it does. And at the Warren event I was at the other day, the organizer at the end, as Warren wrapped up, said, "We'll organize the selfie line here. I know that's what you're really here for." And she wasn't being ironic mm-hmm. or anything
no.
else. I mean, they want to hear Warren speak, but they really want their picture. Can't do that so well, you know, if the candidate is not actually
a selfie with a screen,
in the room.
Yeah, does it?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Well, it's a little meta.
It is.
That is true. But I can say also, you know, having the governor here this week, seeing the students react on the street and as we walked around campus, I'm certain that not every student on this campus is necessarily a fan of Chris Christie. We have a lot of students from New Jersey. His popularity was the lowest among any New Jersey governor when he left office. But I tell you what, everyone wanted a selfie with him. And one girl was even FaceTiming her mom, and she says, "Talk to my mom." And he tells her, "Hey, it's Chris Christie." So there's just something about interacting with a person and in person. And it's from a communication perspective, I don't think that's ever going to change. I think we are social beings. We crave sociality. We crave connection, true connection with other people. And I don't think technology is going to change that.
Let's stay with Iowa, but step away from impeachments. And David, we want to talk to you a little bit more about what you're seeing on the ground there. Let's start. We've talked about him a little bit. Joe Biden. What are we seeing from Biden in Iowa? It seems like there is now kind of a disconnect between Biden in the national polls and Biden in the Iowa polls. How is that playing out on the ground?
Well, it's one of the things that's happened in Iowa for Joe Biden is he hasn't actually been there a lot compared to other candidates. And in particular, Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders have been there a lot more than Joe Biden. Elizabeth Warren's only been there a little bit more. But, you know, it's really hard to connect with Iowa caucus goers if you don't go to Iowa a whole lot, and he hasn't been. I think they're ramping it up. I've seen more events lately, but whatever the strategy was for not physically going there, I think it's not a good strategy.
Well, and what about Kamala Harris? She was supposed to
move
to Iowa. Has she been there?
She did say that, but there's no evidence that she's actually moved to Iowa, even in the sense that she's holding some substantially greater number of events, activities. She's in some real trouble financially, and I expect we will see her even more in Iowa now because she's all but shut down her other operations. And Iowa's kind of her last stand at this point. But, the really interesting thing, to go back to Joe Biden, the really interesting thing about him is that the larger scale events, he just doesn't come across that well. Again, if you put him in a multi-candidate event with Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg, they are stronger speakers in that context. They get larger crowds and so on. But if you put him in a smaller scale event, he's absolutely excellent.
Right.
He's really, really good at connecting with people. The media makes fun of it to some degree, and they shoot pictures sometimes that kind of make it look a little weird. But if you're in the room, if you're seeing it happen, I think it's really very effective.
Yeah.
Iowa was not great for Biden in 2008, and that was kind of essentially where it all ended for him finishing fifth.
That's what I was going to ask is, and I don't mean to interrupt, but is there some Biden fatigue in Iowa?
Well, I'm not sure that's the case. In 2008, he was one of eight or so candidates.
Right.
You had Obama, you had Clinton, and you had Edwards, and no one else was going to break out of that troika in that cycle. A sort of funny story, but we were at the University of Iowa at that time, and it's in Iowa City. It's right downtown. My wife, Alicia, was working in an office right next to downtown, basically. And as she went in one day, there was Joe Biden on the corner just talking to anyone who'd come by. And as she went to lunch, there was Joe Biden still on the corner.
Wow.
I don't know if he'd moved in between, but it seemed like he'd just been there for hours talking to anyone who came by. But it just didn't pay off. However, we became vice president. He came back to Iowa as vice president, and Iowa Democrats absolutely adored him. It got as much, attention as Obama did. I mean, they absolutely adored him. So I think he had every reason to think coming in this time around off that vice presidency would be a different thing than it was in 2008.
Having said all that, is there a sense of what he needs to do in Iowa this time around to be okay?
Yeah. Well. So I actually, and I've talked to one of his key staff guys in Iowa is a former student of mine at the University of Iowa.
Oh, wow.
And we were talking about this. And I said, in many ways, you actually don't necessarily want to be the front runner going into caucus day because you can't surprise. There's nowhere you can go. What matters in Iowa is a lot more about grabbing the media's attention in a positive way than it is about winning. And how do you do that? You surprise. You do better than expected. You go in as the front runner. You're almost certainly not going to do better than expected. You go in polling third and you end up second, or you go in polling fourth and you end up second, and all of a sudden you're getting attention. So in many ways, what Biden mostly has to do in Iowa is not drop out of probably the top three. That's really the story at this point.
And the one thing he still has in his favor is how he polls against President Trump, especially in battleground states where he fares really well against Trump, while the other two top three, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, don't do as well in those head-to-head polls. So having said that, you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, the electability factor, it sounds like in Iowa maybe that is not quite as big as a factor as maybe it is in some other places. And maybe that explains what we're seeing in terms of the polls there.
I mean, historically, it hasn't been as big a factor. Again, we're looking forward rather than backwards. Just listening to people and talking to people, clearly they want to beat Trump. And so clearly, from that standpoint, electability is mattering in a way that maybe hasn't been quite as significant in the past. But they're not necessarily settled on who can beat Trump. And Iowa Democrats, again, for the vast, vast majority of the people I've heard or talked to, they're not necessarily settled on a candidate yet, but they will vote for basically anybody who's the Democrat, right? So I think they see this, you know, they can express who they think should be the candidate, that sincere voting, but they're going to fall back and vote for the nominee no matter what.
We've talked about Biden. We heard you talk about Kamala Harris a little bit. So how about some of the other candidates there? I guess specifically Pete Buttigieg, who seems to be the one who's gaining some momentum there now. Just kind of give us a little sense of, you know, the state of play right now with the rest of the candidates.
So one of the interesting things about Buttigieg is his polling nationally is dramatically different from his Iowa polling at this point. And it does point out, again, the being there part. Mm-hmm. It really points out when you're running a campaign, when you're organizing, when you're actually there, voters have a different impression than they do when there's this generic question nationally, who do you support, and you haven't seen a campaign yet.
Well, and he's right? also campaigning as a Midwesterner, as someone who hunts and has a lot of things in common with Iowans.
Well, the other thing he's started doing recently, and I don't know if this is effective or not, to be honest, but he is tying himself to Obama in an interesting way. So he was at he did a big outdoor event in Des Moines a couple weeks ago now, and his introduction was all about how the introducer talked all about how we're in a situation we were in before this young new face has appeared, and made these parallels to Obama's rise in Iowa mm-hmm. and to Obama himself, and then Buttigieg did as well. And that's particularly striking some people positively, other people rather oddly, because one of the really interesting things about him, he's doing well in Iowa, but he's polling at close to zero with South Carolina African-American voters. And they make up 60% of the electorate in South Carolina. Wow. So the question is, he could maybe do really well in virtually all white Iowa, but still face a pretty significant roadblock very quickly after.
I was going to say, I mean, he could do well in Iowa, maybe use a bounce there to do well in New Hampshire, but then at that point, things start to become a little bit difficult.
Unless we see something shift, right? And things do shift. I mean, it's worth remembering that in 2008, ahead of Iowa, South Carolina African-American voters were primarily in Clinton's camp, not Obama's camp. They did not believe Obama could win. It was when Obama won 95% white Iowa that African-Americans in South Carolina took a new look. And it did change the dynamic. Now, Buttigieg doesn't have the identity thing going for him in the way that Obama did. But a lot of what's keeping – and it's Joe Biden who's polling well among African-Americans in South Carolina. Residual Obama-Biden, Clinton, just all of the sort of that part of the party. But it's also a lot because they do think he's the one who can win. And if he doesn't do well in Iowa, you know, that may shift very rapidly.
You mentioned earlier that this might be kind of Kamala Harris's last stand. You know, how about for the Cory Bookers, the Amy Klobuchar? Is this also kind of last stand time for them? Do they need to do something there? As you said, exceeding expectations.
I think virtually everybody, other than again the four we've mostly been talking about, right? Biden, Warren. We haven't talked much about Sanders, and Buttigieg are likely the top four. If one of the others, Klobuchar, Booker, whomever, Yang, breaks into that top four, that will be a story. And that will help them a lot. But if they don't, I think this will winnow down. Again, I shouldn't make predictions about the future. But this will winnow down, I think, very quickly once we get going. And so it, in many ways, is probably the last stand or close to the last stand for but four or five candidates.
Right.
I want to finish this particular piece of what we're talking about with asking you, what should people know about Iowa that they don't know? As they're watching all this happen, what should they know that maybe might inform, okay, well, now I understand why I'm seeing this kind of dynamic or I'm seeing this type of story or something like that?
So Iowa, particularly these days, is seen as a fairly conservative state. The Republicans, you know, Trump won it by 9 points. The Republicans control the state government. That wasn't true in the last decade. Actually, the Democrats made gains every single year, had control of the state government and so on. But right now it's seen very conservative. And that tends to bleed over to how people think about Iowa Democrats. But in fact, Iowa Democrats are among the more liberal Democrats around. There is this strong progressive element. Bernie Sanders, you know, virtual success there 4 years ago points this out. Iowa Democrats are quite liberal. And in that sense, they're a better representation of the party ideologically than most people think they are. Hmm. So if we think about it from a political standpoint, that's kind of the way to think about it. Beyond that, you know, everybody's heard by now about the Iowa State Fair and fried things on a stick. But it's real. You should go. It's an amazing experience.
Well, this podcast is part of the Center for Political Communications, Direction, Democracy, and National Agenda Series, headed up by Lindsay. We've already name-checked the guest who was here this week a few times, former governor, former New Jersey governor Chris Christie, a UD alum, we should point out. I have to ask you, what are some of the things that kind of stood out for you from what he had to say the other night at Mitchell Hall and just his, you know, kind of his visit here?
His visit was great. It was a beautiful fall day. The university campus looked stunning, and I think he was glad to be back. He hadn't been back for a few years. My students really liked him, even the students who were maybe not for him or from New Jersey and maybe did not appreciate him. He was a really likable guy. It was a lot of fun. The event itself, he had some really interesting takes on the November 5th elections, particularly in Kentucky and Virginia. So that audio and video will be up soon, so you can listen to that or watch it. But I think what was really interesting is he very definitively talked about who he wanted to be or whether he would run for office again in a way that I haven't heard him talk so clearly about it. He basically was like, in 2024, if, you know, all these boxes are checked, you know, my wife's on board and all these things are checked off, I would run for president. And he said that's the only job I'd be looking for. That is the only one. I'm not running for Senate. I'm not running for any of these other things. I'm an executive. And so I think we'll have to keep an eye on him, given his very low popularity rating as recently as 2018 in New Jersey. We will have to see what happens. But I think, you know, nationally, I don't know if people – are there any national polls about him right now? Probably not.
Not right now.
But it'd be interesting to see the comparison because, from my understanding, what happened with Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy, was that this was like New Jersey's 9/11 is what I've heard some people describe it as. So that was why his popularity rating just shot through the roof, much like George W. Bush's popularity rating after the real 9/11. So I think he had nowhere to go but down. And then when he had these several scandals, the beach photo, Bridgegate, I think New Jerseyans were not really pleased with that. We were just looking at some polling out of Eagleton let me pull it up here. This was how residents feel about Governor Christie in 2008. And about half of them, the wording is so funny, about the half of them said, they're glad to see you go, don't let the door hit you on the way out. About 45% said, some of it was good, some of it was bad, but thanks for your service to the state. So there are some people that appreciate what he was doing. However, only about 5% said, we're going to miss you. So,
and the context on that was Christie himself told the media, you're going to miss me.
Yeah.
And so Eagleton decided to actually ask, are we going to miss him?
That's a fun poll. Yeah. I like that one. Yeah. But I think that, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you never know what's going to happen an hour from now or a day from now. I think Christie's a story that's not finished yet. I don't know what necessarily he's going to do, but he wrote his first book. He is still friends with the Trumps, and he's still making commentary on ABC News and on other outlets. So I think his story is far from over, and things can change just as dramatically as they did during his governorship.
Am I allowed to interject here that there is one other job he would want?
Yeah.
And that is a sports talk show host?
That's
true. Probably true, yeah.
And then if someone offered him that job,
that's New York,
true.
That would
discourage him from running for president?
Yeah, it might.
That's very true.
Is that possible?
That's
a thought.
It might be. He loved to go on the radio even when he was governor and talk sports.
Or so. Maybe like run a Bruce Springsteen Sirius channel or something. There's probably already one.
The problem is he's a Cowboy fan, which really hurts him in a lot of
places. It does. And that was one of the things, you know, so I was in New Jersey. I was directing the Rutgers-Eagleton poll for much of Christie's tenure. I left there in 2016, so this poll that Lindsay just talked about was after me.
And we're so happy you came to Delaware.
But it was fascinating to track him. It was fascinating to look at his support. There's this belief now in retrospect that he was somehow wildly popular before 2012. Because he talked last night at the public event about being begged to run for president, you know, the money people were sitting down, which is true. But it wasn't because he was somehow overwhelmingly popular in New Jersey. He had, I think, in fact, a more positive national profile at that point than he did in the state. And then as the storm which just devastated New Jersey, areas have still not recovered. And he was bipartisan. He was a leader. He seemed strong, you know, in the face of all of this. And, you know, he shot up to record high polling for a New Jersey governor. Tom Kaine was the previous record holder, universally beloved, just about. And Christie hit that point and then squandered it. Or his staff squandered it, depending on whose story you believe. And then it just collapsed from there. The fascinating thing is it didn't go back to that kind of 50-50.
It just kept going.
It just kept dropping. Mm. Yeah.
Well, we finish up, as we always do, with our political quick take. Yeah, we say hot quick take, quick hot take, whatever you want to do. David, we'll start with you. What is on your mind as your political quick take?
Looking at the polling in particular, and I think the recent Siena poll, New York Times poll, for example, that looked at a set of battleground states and suggested a toss-up in all of these battleground states. But I think one of the things that is a real challenge is polling these states is extraordinarily difficult. If you dig further into the methodology, and you know, they're very transparent. It's really important that good polls are very transparent, but they all but admit that the Michigan polling is completely uncertain, that it's highly dependent on the assumptions that they make, much more so than usual. I think a lot of Democrats are looking at this and going, oh my God, we're going to lose no matter what we do. But at the same time, I think everybody should just relax about anything having to do with head-to-head national polling for 2020. We're a year away. The correlation between 2020 national polls and the actual outcome a year ahead is close to zero.
Thank you.
So relax. Don't worry about it. Pay attention to what's actually happening.
You made Lindsay's day.
Yeah.
And you still have a political quick take to do.
I do. Well, since Christie kind of took my time at the event, I wasn't able to do my quick take at the event. So I thought, okay, I'll do it. Yeah. I'll do it today. Cancel culture. This is this new phenomenon. Even former President Barack Obama spoke up about it last week. He said, the world's messy. There are ambiguities. People who do really good stuff have flaws. And he says, you don't have to be always politically woke. Get over that. And that's not being an activist. So this brings me to someone I follow on Twitter who I find really fascinating, primarily because she's about my age, is Monica Lewinsky. And in 2015, she famously said, I was patient zero of losing a personal reputation on a global scale, almost instantaneously. And she's absolutely right. She was patient zero for cyberbullying, for cancel culture, for all of these things that we're seeing, these phenomena now. She was literally the first person canceled online for almost 20 years. But since then, she's actually played a public and often self-deprecating role. She has almost 700,000 followers on Twitter and that coveted blue check. She also has just released a new anti-bullying campaign called The Epidemic and is working with a new anti-bullying Twitter tool called the Goodness Bot, where if you see an abusive tweet, you can reply to it with that @goodnessbot and it will turn it into a positive tweet. But even with all these accomplishments related specifically to online shaming and canceling, Lewinsky's still not immune to being called out. So I found it really funny when journalist Yashar Ali, a freelance journalist, basically asked on Twitter, how different an age are you willing to be with a significant other? And her response in a very funny way was like, pass. I'm not going to answer that question. And then the Washington Examiner the next day, headline says, Monica Lewinsky pointedly declined to weigh in on an online discussion about the acceptable maximum age difference for two people in a relationship. And of course, they go on to describe, Lewinsky became nationally known in the 90s for having an affair with then-President Bill Clinton while she was a 22-year-old intern in the White House and he was 49. So she retweeted that and laughed it off with some crying emojis. But it just goes to show you that even patient number one is still a target. And I say if Monica Lewinsky can laugh off cancel culture, I think we can all do it. I think we should make social media a respite from all that anger and hatred. Let's have fun with it. And maybe we can actually cancel culture. Let's make it as fleeting as the latest meme or any other internet phenomenon. Okay, boomer?
Nice touch at the end. Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, nice. UD Center for Political Communication Associate Director, National Agenda Series Director, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Same to you, Dr. David Redlosk, Chair of the UD Department of Political Science and International Relations. We appreciate you parachuting in from Iowa.
You bet.
Instead
Absolutely.
Of being like a reporter who parachutes into
exactly.
Iowa.
Exactly.
That's right.
The other direction. Exactly.
We appreciate it. We thank you both for being on this episode of the Direction Democracy Podcast. I'm Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne. We'll see you again next time. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Direction Democracy Podcast, produced by the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. For more information on the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication's Direction Democracy National Agenda Series this fall, visit cpc.udel.edu. And a reminder, the next Direction Democracy National Agenda Series event is November 20th with John Dellavolpe, who directs polling at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics. That starts at 7:30 at UD's Mitchell Hall.